Ambry presents Next and Now, a podcast on all things genetic.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to our webinar. We hope that this will be a great summary of cardiovascular genetics designed to provide genetic professionals with some of the necessary tools for offering cardiogenetic counseling and testing. As many of you know, Ambry has recently relaunched 10 cardiovascular genetics panels for inherited arrhythmias and cardiomyopathies, in addition to our previous TADNEX panel for aortopathies. Before I take up too much time, let me introduce our speaker. Amy Sturm is a genetic counselor at the Division of Human Genetics at Ohio State Wexner Medical Center in Columbus, Ohio. She's a graduate from the University of Michigan Genetic Counseling Graduate Program, and she has been working in cardiovascular genetics since 2004. She provides genetic counseling services for patients with all types of hereditary cardiovascular diseases. She was a co-founder and one of the two first co-chairs of the Cardiovascular Genetics Special Interest Group of NSGC. And in 2008, she co-chaired the NSGC short course, Taking Heredity to Heart, Cardiovascular Genetics and Overview. She's recently been appointed to the ClinGen Cardiovascular Domain Channelopathy Subcommittee. So let's welcome Amy. Oh, I also wanted to let everyone know that we're going to be having another webinar March 18th at the same time as this one, where we'll present an overview of Ambry's new cardiovascular panel. So hopefully following this great overview from Amy, that will be a great time to learn more about what Ambry offers. So go ahead and take it away, Amy.
Thanks, Melissa. I'd like to start off by just reviewing today's learning objectives. You'll see that I will be describing the basic anatomy and function of the heart. I'll outline the main types of inherited cardiovascular disease, identify the medical and family history characteristics suggestive of these inherited conditions, and finally summarize with demonstrating the unique components of cardiovascular genetic counseling within this subspecialty of genetics. So let's begin here looking at the cardiac anatomy and function. There are four chambers of the heart. The upper are the atria, you can see here with my pointer, and the lower are the ventricles. The septum is the wall of muscle that separates the left and right side of the heart. Four types of valves regulate blood flow throughout the heart. The tricuspid valve regulates blood flow between the right atrium and right ventricle. The pulmonary valve controls blood flow from the right ventricle into the pulmonary arteries, which carry blood to your lungs to pick up oxygen. The mitral valve then lets oxygen-rich blood from the lungs pass back into the heart, from the left atrium into the left ventricle. And then the aortic valve, located at the bottom of the aorta, opens the way for this oxygen-rich blood to be pumped from the left ventricle into the aorta, the body's largest artery, where it is delivered to the rest of the body. Here we have the circulatory system, which includes arteries and veins. And arteries carry the oxygen-rich blood away from the heart. You can see here, again, the thoracic aorta going down through the chest into the abdominal aorta, down to the lower part of the body, with veins then carry the oxygen-poor blood back to the heart for reoxygenation. The heart also has its own electrical system, also known as the conduction system. And this is the internal system that controls the speed and the rhythm of the heartbeat, every single beat the heart takes. Sinus rhythm is the normal rhythm set by the natural pacemaker of the heart called the sinoatrial node, also known as the sinus node. And normal cardiac impulses begin here at the sinoatrial node, are transmitted through the atria and down into the ventricles to control the rhythm of the heartbeat. Any problem with any part of this process throughout the atria and ventricles in any part of the conduction system can cause an abnormal heart rhythm called an arrhythmia. Moving on, I'd like to talk to you about a few general rules of thumb when we think about most inherited cardiovascular conditions. So many of them are actually relatively common diseases that you may see in many pedigrees that you take when working with patients. However, with any genetic condition, as always, you're looking for potentially a younger age of onset. You may also see more severe phenotypes. Most of these diseases, by far, are inherited in an autosomal dominant pattern. However, you may only see one case of a condition in a pedigree, and the pedigree may not appear dominant with that disease in every successive generation. And this is because almost every single one of these conditions also displays significant incomplete age-related reduced penetrance. Also, of course, we are seeing smaller families, and we know that there can be a lot of variability in expression of signs and symptoms of these conditions. And so many of the affected individuals in the family may not even be aware of the symptoms they're having and may not know that they are connected to the hereditary heart disease in the family. Also, studies have shown that self-reported family history of cardiovascular disease is actually not as sensitive or specific as that reported for cancer. Again, overall, for most of these conditions, when a person has a clinical evaluation for them, it should begin with a full medical history, family history, typically an ECG, which is the electrocardiogram, as well as other targeted cardiac tests, depending on the phenotype in question. All first-degree relatives should be referred to a cardiologist for clinical screening, and I will discuss this in great detail for many of the conditions throughout the talk. Genetic testing should be offered to at-risk relatives if a pathogenic variant or variants has been identified in the proband. And we know that a lot of modifiers are in play with these conditions, both environmental and genetic modifiers, relating to how susceptible individual patients in the pedigree may be, as well as their clinical severity. And there is extensive locus and allelic heterogeneity in almost every one of these disorders. These are the common inherited forms of cardiovascular disease I'll be reviewing today: arrhythmias, cardiomyopathies or heart muscle diseases, aneurysms, and familial coronary artery disease, specifically focusing on familial hypercholesterolemia. I won't be able to include congenital heart disease, but just to get it on your radar that we can see this in families with an underlying genetic predisposition as well. So beginning with the arrhythmias, what are the key features of these conditions? Well, they can affect all ages, so you would see these both in a pediatric and an adult setting. They can cause syncope, which is fainting, as well as sudden cardiac death, so they are quite serious conditions. However, there are very effective treatments, and so it is very important to diagnose and identify these conditions and make sure that predictive genetic testing is offered to at-risk relatives. And for most of these conditions, there is genetic testing available with moderate to high clinical sensitivity. Again, these are extremely important to identify because sudden cardiac death, or SCD, can be prevented. So what are these conditions? Well, here I've summarized a list of the hereditary arrhythmia conditions for you. I will be covering today some of the more commonly encountered ones that we see in most inherited arrhythmia clinics: long QT syndrome, Brugada syndrome, and CPVT, or catecholaminergic polymorphic ventricular tachycardia. But overall, when you're taking a pedigree, you should be suspicious for one of these syndromes if you see a family or personal history of syncope, which is again fainting, sudden death, as well as accidental, suspicious, or unexplained death. So drowning in someone who was a good swimmer, or a single motor vehicle accident involving just one person driving a car that doesn't make sense. SIDS, or sudden infant death syndrome, can also be tied to these conditions. Also, if you see individuals with pacemakers or ICDs, which are implantable cardiodefibrillators that had to be implanted, exercise intolerance, and seizures can also be part of these disease spectrums. Starting with long QT syndrome. This is a relatively common genetic arrhythmia with a prevalence of up to 1 in 2,000 individuals based on population electrocardiogram screening. It is clinically identified on an electrocardiogram by a prolonged QT interval, shown here in the figure of this EKG. Patients will present with syncope or sudden cardiac death due to ventricular arrhythmias, so abnormal heart rhythms in the bottom part of the heart, the ventricles. Seizures can be part of this disease spectrum, and this is mainly due to cerebral anoxia or lack of oxygen to the brain. And so a history of seizures in a patient or a family history may be something that was misdiagnosed and was actually an arrhythmia. Overall, mutations in both ion channels and ion channel interacting proteins are involved in the predisposition to long QT syndrome, and they result in a delay in repolarization within the heart and the electrical system, providing an increased risk of arrhythmia. As I alluded to earlier, the variants in these channel genes are also associated with sudden infant death syndrome, or SID. Here in this table, I've summarized three main common long QT syndrome phenotypes. We have long QT 1, 2, and 3, which are the clinical phenotypes caused by mutations in two different potassium channel genes and then this sodium channel gene, SCN5A. The most common type is long QT1, accounting for over 60% of cases, with long QT being second most common and type 3 being the third most common, but much more rare. When you're working with a cardiologist or electrophysiologist, they may be able to identify specific T wave patterns on the electrocardiogram that may be part of these phenotypes. And you can see that between the different phenotypes, there is a diversity in how common it is for a patient to have a cardiac event. And when I say cardiac event, I'm referring to both syncope and sudden cardiac death. So you can see that most commonly with long QT1, you may see more of a clinical presentation. And with patients with long QT type 3, there is much more reduced penetrance. We also know that for each one of these individual phenotypes, there may be different triggers to the arrhythmia. And so for long QT type 1, exercise, sudden emotion, swimming can be seen as event triggers. We know for long QT, and particularly the postpartum period after pregnancy, is a high-risk period. And for long QT type 3, oftentimes the arrhythmia happens when a person is at rest or in sleep. You can see here, too, the sudden death risk with these conditions is hovering right around 4%, with long QT type 3 having a slightly higher risk for sudden death. There is clinical genetic testing available for long QT syndrome, and to date, at least 13 genes have been associated with this phenotype. Clinical sensitivity of most genetic testing is typically around 75%. And interestingly, up to 10% of patients may have more than one genetic variant associated with their long QT phenotype. Interestingly and importantly as well, at least 5% of patients may have normal DNA sequencing, but may have a deletion or duplication abnormality. And a recent study published by Bark et al. In the Journal of the American College of Cardiology in 2011 showed that copy number variants in the two most common potassium channel genes explained approximately 3% of long QT in patients with no point mutation in these genes. And so it's very important to make sure if a patient has normal DNA sequencing to rule out a copy number variant, especially in the two most common genes. Again, once the pathogenic variant has been identified, genetic testing should be offered to all first-degree relatives, regardless of whether they have an abnormal QT interval on their EKG or not, because not every patient with the genetic predisposition will have a finding on their electrocardiogram. And this is a recommendation of the Heart Rhythm Society genetic testing guidelines for genetic testing, which I'll give you the reference for later. Long QT can be managed, especially type 1, quite effectively with beta blocker medications. Some patients, especially if they've had a previous syncopal episode or sudden cardiac arrest, will require implantation of a ICD. And there are also many preventive measures we counsel patients about, including avoiding specific drugs that can actually make that QT prolongation even worse. And these medications can be found on a website called qtdrugs.org. or crediblemeds.org. And there are many common medications on this list, including antibiotics, antidepressants, and so it's very important for patients to receive this information. Also, we need to have discussions with patients about the avoidance of adrenergic type stimuli, including alarm clocks, other loud noises. And there needs to be a very detailed counseling session focused in on if a patient is heavily involved in athletic activity. We all know that, of course, a certain amount of exercise is very good for the heart, but in these patients, unfortunately, exercise can be a risk factor. And especially if a patient is involved heavily in competitive athletics, there may be some restrictions or limited participation that do need to be recommended to the patient. Brugada syndrome would be the next condition we talk about. Brugada has been more relatively recently identified, and so its overall incidence is difficult to ascertain. But it is thought to be the most common cause of sudden death in younger individuals in South Asia. Interestingly, there is a very high male-to-female prevalence with a ratio of 8 or 9 to 1, higher prevalence in males to females. It is characterized by very specific electrocardiogram findings, including 3 different Brugada-type patterns that can be seen on an ECG. Patients typically present with episodes of syncope or sudden cardiac death. These are caused by very fast ventricular tachycardia, so a very fast heart rate in the lower chambers of the heart, or ventricular fibrillation, which is a rhythm that is just absolutely uncontrolled and fast in the bottom chambers of the heart. This condition typically presents a little bit older during adulthood with a mean age of sudden death at approximately age 40, but there is a very wide range that has been published. And typically we see this condition being inherited with an autosomal dominant with incomplete penetrance pattern. Variants in the sodium channel gene, which again, if you recall, this is the gene associated with type 3 long QT syndrome, are the most common known cause of Brugada syndrome. Up to 14 different genes have been found to be associated in different research studies, and our current genetic testing sensitivity is about 30% in this area. Very interestingly, though, there has also been a lot of discussion about a possible complex inheritance model with Brugada syndrome. And while it is most commonly considered a Mendelian disorder, we also think that complex inheritance is playing a strong role with Brugada syndrome probands. And this is because overall, we do see low penetrance. We see many sporadic cases of Brugada syndrome. There have been studies that have shown that in some affected family members with Brugada syndrome clinical features and ECG features, they do not have the known familial sodium channel variant that has been found in their family. And linkage analyses have not been successful in discovering new disease-causing genes. In fact, a recent genome-wide association study was published in Nature Genetics in 2013 that showed a role for common genetic variation in the susceptibility to Brugada syndrome. And they discovered and then replicated 3 different single nucleotide polymorphisms that were not only associated with Brugada syndrome, but as a higher number of these risk alleles was present in patients from 1 up to 3, there was a cumulative effect of risk for Brugada syndrome susceptibility. And so many of the probands with Brugada syndrome may have a stronger genetic load of risk variants and not one major Mendelian genetic variant that is playing a role. We'll next talk about CPVT. Catecholaminergic polymorphic ventricular tachycardia is a little less common, with about 1 in 10,000 individuals affected. Here in the figure, you can see an individual who has undergone exercise treadmill testing. And so this is a person who has been hooked up to the electrocardiogram electrodes on their chest and is asked to exercise on a treadmill. And you can see that in a patient with CPVT, what happens is that when the heart undergoes stress, and this can be emotional stress or exercise-related stress, that individual will have their rhythm go into this polymorphic ventricular tachycardia denoted in this rhythm strip. And then when the patient stops exercising, shown here in the recovery phase, that heart rhythm goes back to normal. So again, this is a condition where release of catecholamines, and this can, again, be exercise, emotional, or stress-induced, can cause dysfunction in certain ion channels in the cardiomyocytes or heart muscle cells. Typically, these patients will have a structurally normal heart. Syncope is typically triggered by emotional and physical stress, and usually this is the first clinical sign, but sudden death may be the first manifestation. Onset is typically in the first decade of life, so this condition, you'll see an earlier age of onset than you would with Brugada syndrome. And if untreated, about 1 in 3 patients will have at least 1 cardiac arrest, and up to 80% will have at least 1 episode of syncope. Also, about 1 in 3 patients who have CPVT will have a positive family history of both premature sudden death or stress-related syncope. However, this means that maybe even up to 2/3 of patients may not have a positive family history. And so when you have just an isolated proband that you're suspicious of for this condition, genetic testing would still be warranted. Beta blockers are the preferred therapy, and they should be at maximal dose. And some patients may even require implantation of an ICD, since some patients may still have arrhythmias even while taking beta blockers. By far, the most common gene associated with CPVT is the RYR2 or ryanodine receptor. And this accounts for well over 50% of cases of CPVT, and these are inherited in an autosomal dominant pattern. But there are other genes that have been associated to be found in CPVT patients as well. I'd now like to move on and talk about the cardiomyopathies, which are heart muscle disorders. So overall, these are diseases of the heart muscle itself, the myocardium, and they can cause many different types of issues with the heart muscle. It can become enlarged, quite dilated, it can thicken up, or it can become very stiff. And as this condition worsens in patients, the heart becomes much weaker, it's less able to pump blood, it's less able to maintain a normal rhythm, and this can lead to many downstream medical problems, including heart failure, arrhythmias, and possibly sudden death. It is among the leading indications for heart transplantation, is a major cause of mortality in the United States, can affect all age ranges, and can be acquired, but is also many times inherited. These are the many different types of inherited cardiomyopathy that can be seen in patients. I will be focusing today on the two most common types, dilated and hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. But there are other phenotypes that are very important to be aware of as well, including arrhythmogenic, restrictive, and left ventricular cardiomyopathies. Also very important to note with the cardiomyopathies is that there can be so-called phenocopy conditions, which are cardiomyopathies associated with actual genetic syndromes, such as hypertrophic cardiomyopathy being a part of Fabry disease, Noonan syndrome, and others. And with dilated cardiomyopathy, we can see this condition in many different types of muscular dystrophies. And so it's important that we recognize that in many of these patients with the cardiomyopathies, they may actually have a syndrome at play, which is important to identify because not only may some of these conditions require very specific treatment, but many of them are inherited in different inheritance patterns, such as recessive or X-linked. So starting with dilated cardiomyopathy, or DCM, you can see in this figure a picture of a normal heart and then also this picture with this big dilated ventricle, so this left ventricle that's just become enlarged, weaker, dilated, thinner wall, so the muscle is not as strong. And therefore, this left ventricle is less effective in pumping blood, and these patients can develop heart failure and arrhythmias. There are many different acquired causes of DCM, and this includes CAD, which is coronary artery disease, one of the most common types of heart disease. Also, certain infections, alcohol and drug abuse, or toxins can cause DCM. But the cause remains unknown in at least half of cases. We term this idiopathic DCM. And we know that a high percentage of patients with idiopathic DCM have a positive family history. Now, that being said, many cases of idiopathic DCM will not have a self-reported family history, but when clinical screening commences through a family with ECG and echocardiogram, even additional relatives are identified who have the condition, but may be asymptomatic. And so therefore, the Heart Failure Society of America, in their practice guideline on cardiomyopathy, recommends that a thorough 3-generation pedigree be taken on every person with idiopathic DCM. The genetics of DCM show extensive locus and allelic heterogeneity, and many different types of genes with diverse ontologies can be associated with this disease. Most do lead toward autosomal dominant inheritance, but we can also see recessive, X-linked, and mitochondrial inheritance. And in these patients, you may see extra cardiac features, more syndromic presentations, and potentially even more early onset and pediatric onset. The current clinical molecular genetic testing sensitivity reaches maybe up to 40%, And similar to Brugada, we're beginning to understand that the Mendelian paradigm for DCM, especially cases of what appear to be sporadic DCM, is likely incomplete. This table shows many of the different genes that have been shown to be associated and causative of DCM, and you can see again that there is a diverse ontology with genes associated with the sarcomere, the major contractile unit within heart muscle cells, the cytoskeleton itself, as well as many other different types of genes. Now, a landmark finding that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2012 was that truncations of a protein called chitin are a major cause of DCM. And really, this research had never been able to be previously done because chitin is the largest protein in the entire human body. And without our newer next-gen sequencing approaches, really the sequencing of this gene just couldn't be done effectively. But this study published research findings in over 300 subjects with DCM compared to about 250 controls. And what they found was that truncating variants, so our nonsense, frameshift, splice site, or indel type mutations in the chitin gene, accounted for up to 1 in 4 cases, or 25% of familial DCM. Also, 18% of sporadic idiopathic DCM had a chitin truncating variant, but complicating matters, 3% of the controls in this study also had a chitin truncating variant. And what we have come to understand is that because this gene is just so large, that it's likely that almost everyone in the general population has at least one chitin variant. These variants are still somewhat difficult to interpret, and this is because there are multiple isoforms of chitin, there are multiple reference sequences, but we are beginning to learn a lot more about if a chitin variant is in a specific location within the protein, that it may indeed have a higher likelihood to be pathogenic. But it's very important to know that chitin is an important cause of DCM. With DCM, we do also see incomplete and age-dependent penetrance, as well as a lot of variable expression, both within and between families. And families often demonstrate a very wide range of symptoms, even in close first-degree relatives with the same genetic variant, where you can see very subtly affected individuals with close relatives who may even acquire transplant or have significant DCM with heart failure. We can see a wide age of onset, and so it is important to do pediatric screening with this condition, and this is crucial, of course, to convey in genetic counseling. Hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, it has a prevalence of about 1 in 500, so it is very common, one of the most common Mendelian cardiovascular conditions and a very important cause of sudden cardiac death in young individuals. It's also the most common cause of sudden cardiac death in young athletes, and the majority of idiopathic forms are genetic. And you can see here the normal heart and here a heart with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy with this left ventricular muscle just very significantly thickened. So again, the clinical features include this unexplained left ventricular hypertrophy or thickening. It can be diffuse, but typically it's maximal in the septum in between the two ventricles. Localized forms have also been seen. And there may be outflow tract obstruction. So going back here to the picture, you may see this thickening of the left ventricular wall or septum so thick that the outflow tract or the blood flow from the left ventricle into the aorta is completely blocked, and these patients may actually require surgery called septal myectomy to cut out that thickened tissue. The clinical spectrum is diverse. Again, you'll see a variable age of onset, but some of the most common symptoms include chest pain, exertion-related dyspnea, which is shortness of breath or impaired consciousness. Other patients may have exercise intolerance that worsens over time, and some of the most severe cases may present with heart failure. And some patients may, of course, also have unexpected sudden death. But the majority of individuals with this condition actually remain asymptomatic, and for many patients, their life expectancy is not altered. There is a risk, though, like I stated, for sudden cardiac death with HCM, which is actually somewhat higher in younger children and adolescents as the heart is growing. And after they reach and grow out of this higher risk period, is about a 0.5% to 1% annual frequency risk in adults. Usually, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy is inherited in an autosomal dominant pattern. We do again see a lot of locus as well as allelic heterogeneity. So most genetic testing for hypertrophic cardiomyopathy includes multiple different genes and full gene sequencing to make sure we can identify all the possible genetic predispositions. Most of the genes involved in predisposition to hypertrophic cardiomyopathy encode components of that sarcomere that I alluded to previously, which again is the contractile unit that is very important for overall heart muscle function within the heart muscle cells called the cardiomyocytes. Here in this pie chart, you can see that overall, in just all comers with HCM, the genetic testing clinical sensitivity is approximately 50%, with most patients having a mutation in one of these two sarcomere genes, the myosin binding protein C or the beta myosin heavy chain. As patients have positive family histories, or if they have younger ages of onset, also actually female programs with HCM may have a higher likelihood that clinical genetic testing will find their causative mutation. So the overall clinical sensitivity ranges from about 50 up to 60%, with cases with a positive family history having a higher clinical sensitivity. We see many private variants, and so many of these patients have private variants unique to just their family alone, and also up to maybe 5% of hypertrophic cardiomyopathy patients may have more than one gene variant and be double or compound heterozygotes. Typically, these patients will have a more severe phenotype, and when you see a pedigree where there may be a diversity in clinical presentation between close relatives, for example, an infant with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy in the setting of a family history of later onset, it is indeed warranted to search for more than one pathogenic variant in the patient that has the much more severe phenotype. And this may necessitate doing panel genetic testing in not just one person in the family, but potentially more than one, depending on who you test first in the family. This practice guideline, published by the Heart Failure Society of America, is a great resource that I wanted to make sure everyone logging in today is aware of. It provides clinical screening recommendations for all of the different types of cardiomyopathies, for both asymptomatic at-risk relatives who have a disease-predisposing variant, as well as those at-risk relatives if genetic testing has not been able to identify the particular variant, or if genetic testing has just not been done yet. This is a table summarizing all of those screening guidelines, and you can see again for each of the different cardiomyopathy phenotypes, specific guidelines are present there for you to be able to utilize to provide to families who are at risk for these conditions. Multiple different types of clinical screening tests, including history and physical examination, are recommended, and you can see that different types of cardiac tests are recommended depending on what the specific phenotype is in the family. For example, some patients with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy or arrhythmogenic types of cardiomyopathy may require Holter monitoring, which is a 24-hour type monitor that patients wear to evaluate their heart rhythms over time. That being said, we have these guidelines, but clinical screening always needs to be delivered to individual patients on a personalized case-by-case basis. Starting off with the fact that screening should absolutely be initiated at any time signs or symptoms appear. And so if a person starts feeling palpitations, shortness of breath, other cardiac-related signs or symptoms, they should, of course, present to medical attention. Also, at-risk first-degree relatives with any abnormal clinical screening test, and this is regardless of genotype, should be considered for repeat clinical screening at 1 year's time, since we need to really pay attention more to their phenotype, not always just the genotype in all cases. Also, some recommendations have been provided for individuals who are considered to be specifically athletic individuals. And so for hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, for example, even moving out to second-degree relatives in families, if genetic testing has not been able to be performed or find the exact genetic variant in the family, it's recommended that more distant relatives to the proband, especially if they are highly athletic, also undergo clinical screening. Finally, if at-risk relatives have normal screening results, it does not keep them clear from the possibility that they may develop cardiomyopathy in the future, since, of course, we see variable ages of onset in these conditions. And so really serial screening, continued screening over time needs to be recommended. Moving on to the aneurysm. There are many different hereditary aneurysm and dissection syndromes. And here in this figure, you'll again just see the aorta arising off the top of the heart and the thoracic aorta, which is located in the chest, moving down to the abdominal aorta, all connected down into the abdomen. And here you can visualize an aortic aneurysm or this bulge-like type weakening in the artery vessel wall. These conditions can also be associated with something called a dissection, which is when the actual lining of the vessel tears or rips, blood will pool down in this area, which can cause further instability of that particular lining of the vessel. And some of these dissections can be extremely severe and go throughout a lot of the patient's vasculature. So I'll start off by talking about the thoracic aortic aneurysms and dissections conditions. There are non-syndromic cases, and this condition is called familial thoracic aortic aneurysms and dissections, or TAD. And what we know is that research has shown that if you look at isolated individuals who have a thoracic aortic aneurysm or dissection, 1 in 5 of those people will have an affected first-degree relative and will have this condition called familial TAD. There are also syndromic cases, including Marfan, Loeys-Dietz, and Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which are connective tissue disorders associated with multiple different types of syndromic features. We also know that there is a genetic component to familial abdominal and intracranial aneurysms within the brain, but these conditions aren't as well researched, and for most of the time, there isn't good clinical genetic testing available in today's world. So going back to familial TAD, or the thoracic aortic aneurysms and dissections, what you may see in patients is a dilation of the aorta at the ascending aorta, so that part of the aorta that first ascends off the top of the heart. You can also see, though, aneurysms and dissections really throughout the entire ascending aorta, also the descending thoracic aorta, and aneurysms involving other arteries throughout the body. So 12% of families have been shown to have abdominal aneurysms. We also see significant percentage of families with cerebral or brain aneurysms, as well as in their peripheral vasculature. We can also see certain congenital defects like patent ductus arteriosus or bicuspid aortic valves in some of these probands and their families. This is an autosomal dominant condition, and approximately 20% of the genetic causes have been identified thus far. We do see reduced penetrance and variable expression. And the variable expression is interesting that it can affect at what age patients have their onset, also the rate of progression at how fast the aorta may dilate, the degree of dilation prior to a dissection, and location of dissection. There is specific management that is required for these individuals, including surveillance of the ascending aorta and really the entire aorta, including imaging of the cerebral vasculature. These patients will need to take certain medications and may even require surgery, and also should be recommended to avoid certain isometric exercises as well as many different types of competitive athletics. At-risk relatives in these families also need to be screened on a serial fashion, and their ascending aorta, their entire aorta, also need to be evaluated, including potential other types of areas of their vasculature, depending on what is present in their family history. Also in these families, screening really does need to begin at a relatively young age because of the variable age of onset. And so even considering screening in childhood is important in these families. And all first-degree relatives of affected people should be screened, parents, siblings, and offspring. Because, again, we can see the variable age of onset, screening should go backward from the proband into the previous generation, with parental screening commencing as well. Moving on to familial hypercholesterolemia, which we also like to call FH for short. This is a condition that is very common, and it is a genetic cause of premature or early onset coronary heart disease associated with heart attack, also known as myocardial infarction. And this is due to the fact that these patients are exposed throughout their lifetime to elevated LDL, or the bad cholesterol, the low-density lipoprotein cholesterol, from the time they are born. It is an autosomal dominant condition, but we do see a gene dosage effect. And so homozygotes or compound heterozygotes who have two mutations have a much higher LDL level, as well as earlier onset of their coronary heart disease compared to heterozygotes. This is a very highly penetrant condition, and it's also very prevalent, with recent exome sequencing studies showing that even approximately 1 in 200 individuals having a variant in the most common gene associated with this condition. Patients who have heterozygous FH have a 20-fold increased risk for early onset heart disease. Many patients unfortunately present with heart disease. But what's so important to know is that in properly treated patients, mortality is similar to the general population. Now, two numbers that I hope you remember after today's webinar are these two numbers here. And these are guidelines that have been put forth by the National Lipid Association, and that FH should be suspected if you see in an adult an LDL cholesterol value greater than or equal to 190. So remember that 190 number. If it is in a pediatric patient or someone under the age of 20, if you see an LDL cholesterol greater than or equal to 160, you need to be suspicious for FH. And the next step that's recommended when you're suspicious is to take a family history and to see if high cholesterol and premature heart disease is present. There are physical exam findings that can be present, but if they're not there, it does not rule out this condition. You can see buildup of cholesterol called xanthomas on the Achilles tendon, on the hand. You can see lipid deposits in the eye called a corneal arcus, and this is especially specific and sensitive to FH diagnosis under the age of 45. And this is a young child with homozygous FH with a very severe presentation of eruptive xanthomas on this individual's hands and knees. The main gene associated with FH is the LDL receptor, and by far it accounts for the majority of FH cases, but also genes are important as well. And we still have more research to do because we don't understand all the genetic underpinnings of this condition. This condition is so common and so treatable that the CDC Office of Public Health Genomics has classified it as one of their few Tier 1 genomic applications, right up there with newborn screening, BRCA testing, and Lynch syndrome or hereditary colon cancer tumor sequencing. And so we really consider FH to be this winnable battle, and it's very important to diagnose and then do cascade clinical testing throughout a family in hopes of preventing the complications from this disease. Children need to have screening in these families. Not only has the National Lipid Association and National Heart and Lung Blood Institute recommended universal cholesterol screening for children between ages 9 and 11, but for children and families with FH or premature cardiovascular disease, they are recommended to consider having screening beginning even at age 2 years. I'd now like to talk a little bit more about the major red flags that you should be looking for when you are taking an informative pedigree, which again is an essential tool for incorporating cardiovascular genetic medicine. Of course, at least three generations should be evaluated. And family history is very imperative in diagnosis, determining an inheritance pattern, identifying at-risk relatives, and again, selecting the best person to initiate genetic testing in. Now, again, remember, family history is great, but again, with self-reported information, it can only take us so far with its sensitivity and specificity. Now, some of the important red flags that I wanted to have you be able to keep kind of in your toolkit for evaluating family histories and determining if you're seeing red flags for potential cardiovascular genetic evaluation are listed here on this summary slide. So if you see an individual with a heart attack, first of all, question whether that was really truly a myocardial infarction associated with atherosclerosis. A lot of patients report heart attack, and it may even be a primary arrhythmia, possibly even an aortic dissection, cardiomyopathy. And so getting medical records, death certificates, autopsy reports is always extremely helpful in these cardiovascular genetic evaluations. I've also gone on to list a lot of other red flags that if you see these in the pedigree, should be piquing your concern for a cardiovascular genetic condition. Sudden death, syncope or presyncope, exercise intolerance, transplantation, early onset heart failure, multiple family members with implanted devices, again, SIDS and seizures. And I've also listed here in the sub-bullets the conditions that you may be thinking about if you see these red flags. Finally, it's so important to work as a team when you're approaching these families and working through them, the families with the hereditary heart disease. The cardiologist, of course, is the primary caretaker taking care of their heart. We, as the genetic counselors, are there to provide all of the information that I've been able to share with you today about risk, inheritance patterns, chance to have positive genetic testing, other potential types of results on genetic testing. We oftentimes work very closely with pathologists who are reviewing autopsy reports or cardiac biopsies and helping us really dig in and look at that heart tissue and helping with differential diagnoses. We oftentimes are also working hand-in-hand with coroners and medical examiners, the ones who may have performed the autopsies on these patients or family members that have sudden cardiac death, seeing if we can access samples for genetic testing. We also work very closely with many researchers who can help us research a lot of the novel variants we're identifying on the genetic testing panels, hoping to determine whether they do indeed have functional significance and are indeed pathogenic. There are many different patient support groups and other medical team members that we work with when we're evaluating these cardiovascular genetic families. There are special considerations that are different and unique to cardiovascular genetic counseling compared to other subspecialties. Again, I've said this previously, but this is a really important take-home point. When at all possible, you should initiate genetic testing in the patient with the most severe phenotype. This will give you the highest clinical sensitivity, and because many of these patients have compound or double mutations, you want to make sure you're giving it your best shot to identify all potential genetic variants playing a role in that family. Clinical presentation of certain patients or families may require large panels inclusive of multiple phenotypes. I oftentimes see a lot of patients that have both conduction system disease or electrical problems in the heart, and then family histories of things like heart failure. And so with these types of families, we really want to make sure we're evaluating certain conduction system, arrhythmia, heart failure, and cardiomyopathy genes. We also, in our clinic, have been, when panel negative, moving on to consider whole exome sequencing, especially if you have an informative family or a trio where you think you can do this, or if you think your family looks consistent, possibly with de novo or recessive inheritance. Again, in many of these families, we may be coordinating post-mortem genetic testing because the first person that may present in some of these families is the person who has experienced a sudden cardiac death. And the NSGC Cardiovascular Genetics Special Interest Group had a team that put together some wonderful, extremely useful resources here at nsgc.org/postmortem that can really help you walk through all the things you need to know about how to coordinate this type of genetic testing for patients and families. Even though many of these conditions are adult onset, we oftentimes do consider and talk extensively with families about predictive genetic testing in children. And this is because of the variable ages of onset we can see in so many of these phenotypes and the importance of potentially interacting and getting, whether it be medications or other things, to at-risk children when they need them. It may also be a good time to have discussions with families and their children about participation in different types of activities, especially, of course, athletics and competitive athletics. And if you have a variant that has a very strong evidence that it's playing the pathogenic role in the family and you can do predictive genetic testing in children, you of course can be able to hopefully release certain children who didn't inherit the pathogenic variant from long-term, year after year, clinical serial screening. There are also some unique psychosocial counseling issues and needs that we experience with these families. They have to adapt to living with these devices that, while they may save their lives, aren't without issues. Several patients may need battery replacements for their defibrillator, or they may need to have new defibrillators implanted if they had faulty problems. Some patients' defibrillators actually provide them shocks that aren't necessary based on certain settings that are very difficult to set with the defibrillator. These patients also need to deal with taking a lot of different types of daily medications oftentimes. Again, I've talked about this with many of the conditions, but some of these will have activity restrictions. I've worked with many very highly athletic families over the years, and this, of course, is a major loss to them. Also, I've worked with patients who were teenagers who may have wanted to go into careers such as law enforcement, where I had one young gentleman with CPVT who then had to make the very difficult decision to change his career path. These patients are dealing with a risk for sudden death, and not only their own personal risk, but fear for their children. And many of these patients have a lot of concern and questions about insurance discrimination, really oftentimes specific to life insurance discrimination. So this is important to definitely include in your pre-genetic testing counseling of these families and patients. Another take-home message with these conditions, and this figure really shows and summarizes this, is the relationship between so many of the genes that can be tied to more than one phenotype. And I've talked here about the sodium channel gene, for an example, which is not only associated with channelopathies, including long QT and Brugada syndrome, but can also be seen in other types of conduction system disease and even dilated cardiomyopathy. And so again, we see a lot of genetic overlap, extensive locus heterogeneity here you see connected to dilated cardiomyopathy. And this is why some of the genetic testing panels are, of course, built the way they are. In summary, we do have a lot of utility and value for this information. Confirmatory diagnostic testing, again, identification of those phenocopies, so those syndromic diseases that may require specific therapies again and that may have different types of inheritance. We can confirm that familial presentations and sporadic presentations do indeed have a molecular genetic etiology. And if we can do that, then we can offer predictive genetic testing again to at-risk relatives. Clinical screening is necessary in all of these families, again, oftentimes with very specific types of screening that needs to be done. We can offer therapeutic interventions in the form of medications as well as devices. Some of these patients will opt for prenatal or PGD. And we know that early identification of those at risk can be life-saving. If you want to start providing cardiovascular genetic services, this is a nice list that you can provide to potential referring providers. This again summarizes disorders with genetic testing available. These are the guidelines that I have alluded to throughout my talk, including the Heart Failure Society of America and Heart Rhythm Society guidelines, which give a lot of great information about genetic testing and clinical screening guidelines. Also, I think what's wonderful to know is that our wonderful source, Gene Reviews, has many different write-ups on all of these different inherited cardiovascular conditions, most of which remain very current today. And finally, I'll close with this list of additional resources for you. There are many professional societies. Of course, the NSGC does have its own cardiovascular genetic special interest group, which is a great group for you to join if you want to get started in this area. Patient advocacy organizations for many of the different phenotypes, as well as registries. So thank you very much for your attention today.
Okay, great. Thank you, Amy, for that great webinar. Okay, great. I think that's all we have time for. So feel free to contact me or Amy directly if you guys have additional questions after this. So I thank everyone for coming, and a special thanks to Amy for doing a wonderful overview of cardiovascular genetics. I think she achieved a huge feat in just an hour. So thank you, everybody. Thanks.
This has been an Ambry Genetics production of Next and Now. To learn more, visit ambrygen.com.